fasten your seatbelt, and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, our journey takes us to the other side of the world, to a tiny Eastern European country nestled between Romania and Ukraine, a country of gypsy melodies and ancient folk dances, a country of contrasts, like its neighbor Ukraine, one side looking to the progressive European West, and the other side, a lawless breakaway province across the Dniester River, looking east and looking back toward Mother Russia. This is a country on the edge, culturally and politically, viewed by some with trepidation as the next likely target of Vladimir Putin's Russian troops. And the people of the area known as Transnistria have already declared their independence from Greater Moldova and asked for annexation to Russia. Moldova used to be known as the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, and when it achieved its independence at the end of the Cold War, our guest today helped bring its struggling farmers into a new economy, help them adapt to a modern agricultural marketplace. Tom Cadwallader is a retired Lincoln County UW Extension agent, and he spent many years traveling between his home in Merrill and his work in Moldova through the Farmer to Farmer program administered by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Tom Cadwallader came to know the culture, the people, and the political realities of Moldova, and he's here to share his stories with us today. He's also here to take your phone calls at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can post a question on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Tom, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much, Glenn. I really appreciate the time.
And this is an educational job that I have because I have spent the last couple of days researching an area that I knew very little about, and that I think speaks volumes maybe about the lack of knowledge that many Americans have about important developments in important parts of the world.
Yeah, that's very common. It's when I come back from my projects, I often will do talks at Lions Club, Rotary, different groups in here at UWMC, and people are just aren't aware of this part of the world. So it's because of these interactions that we start to learn about other people in the globe.
Well, because of what's happening in Crimea, a lot of people are learning very quickly about it, and hopefully we can spread some more knowledge over the next hour. Let's get right into it, and then we'll back up and talk about your personal experiences. Most people have never heard of Moldova, and chances are a lot of people are surprised at the introduction that I just made at the start of the show. NATO's Supreme Allied Commander General, Philip Breedlove, said this week that Moldova's ethnic Russian Transnistria region could be Vladimir Putin's next target. Tell us what you know of that area, and does that make sense to you that the top commander in NATO would express those concerns?
It doesn't surprise me that he expressed the concern. Because of my experience, I've been trying to keep up with all the changes, what's been going on. And it's questionable because it's a risk, too, because Transnistria, they've pronounced different ways. The area is always affiliated itself with Russia. And it still
has... Well, that's like Crimea.
Yeah, it still has in the capital area, outside of their government building, it still has a statue of Lenin, and those are all gone in Moldova. So the group there, the people there, have always tried to maintain that relationship, and the Russians have maintained a military presence there. They've called themselves advisors, but it's part of the residual Soviet division that was there at the breakup of the Soviet Union. They just kind of hung around and supported them. But it's a long way away from Russia. I mean, it's basically you got to go all the way through the Ukraine before you mm-hmm. get to Russia. So they've maintained political affiliations, but it's a big risk. I mean, to get to Transnistria. you have to go all the way across the southern part of Ukraine.
But they could do that from Crimea, couldn't they? They could march the troops right. The southern part of Ukraine is by and large Russian, isn't it? Ethnic Russian, or am I mistaken?
Yes and no. It's when you move out of Crimea into southern Russia or into southern Ukraine, you'll find communities that within that region that are more heavily Russian, people who affiliate themselves as being Russian. And so it's kind of a stepping stone as you walk across eastern Ukraine and across southern Ukraine towards there. So it's not a straight shot. It's not like the whole population, but you're going to find community and city centers that tend to be more ethnically related to or consider themselves to be Russian. And that goes back into some of the history during the Soviet era, and that is where it wasn't uncommon for large communities to be moved into new areas.
And is that what happened in Transnistria? Is that
yes.
why they have such a heavy Russian population?
Yes.
So the old Soviet Union moved a lot of Russian people there.
Yeah, and that's, if you go back in history of the region, that's not uncommon. I mean, the Tsars did it. Catherine the Great did it. That's not uncommon for people and communities to be moved and to either set up new communities or to to move in, and they'll move the natives out and move them somewhere else. And that's kind of what happened in the Transnistria area.
Now, what I have read is that Transnistria has a hammer and sickle on its flag.
Yep.
They've got a parliament that they call the Supreme Soviet. They've got a Soviet-sounding national anthem, and about half of the people, about a half million people live there, and about a half of them are ethnic Russians.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they would like to, if given a chance, they would love to be folded back into the Russian sphere. So, but they've been kind of an island sitting out there. But there gets to be the practical thing of actually getting there in terms of rail and actually, now it gets into the squishy area to get there, it would be making, the Russians would have to basically say, okay, we're going through Ukraine, we're going to fold this region back in. A much bolder move than what's going on with Crimea.
Well, they've set that up so that they could do it if they wanted to, but it might not be in their interest. The Russian parliament has passed a law just in the last couple of months with all of this going on in Crimea, which would allow Russia to annex any area that doesn't have what it would view as a legitimate governing authority if a referendum was held and the people in that area asked to be annexed into Russia. So from the Russian standpoint, they've got a law set up right now which would allow them to do that if they wanted to take the geopolitical risks.
That's what it comes down to, is whether they're willing to take the geopolitical risk. And that's where beyond the scope that I worked at, that's where it's
You were working with farmers.
I was working with farmers, rural communities, in rural economic development things. So it was a kind of a combination of farmers at times, but at other times I would work with small rural communities on agricultural and economic development projects.
Now, if you just joined us, we're talking to Tom Cadwallader. He's a UW Extension agent, retired agent from Merrill, from Lincoln County, who spent portions of 10 years in Moldova, which is right on the Ukrainian border and has a heavily ethnic Russian province that some fear may be the target of Vladimir Putin's troops. If you want to find out more about the Transnistria region, we have posted a link to a story on it from the Miami Herald and another one from National Public Radio on our Route 51 Facebook page. You can also post a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page or a question for Mr. Cadwallader, and I'll read it live on the air. Or if you want, you can give us a phone call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Well, Transnistria is a breakaway province. It's already declared its independence from Moldova. It's asked Russia for annexation. I mean, it's set up if the cards were right.
Oh, yeah. If they had a vote of the people again to say we want to be part of, yeah, they'll clearly, even if everybody voted just by the pure numbers, they would clearly win the election to be annexed, just like they did in Crimea. It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
But Putin has said that he doesn't have any additional designs on Ukrainian territory, and he also has said that he doesn't have any desire to admit Transnistria to the Russian Federation. First of all, does that make sense to you? I know you're not a political scientist, but does that make sense in terms of what you know about maybe the economy of Transnistria? Would it be a boon to Russia to have that territory?
Not really. It's the what they found themselves in is because they've been kind of this pawn in the bigger game. And I think in your introduction, you really did an excellent job saying, you know, the idea is that this is where the collision is. This is an area of transition between the East and the West. That whole region through there has always been a buffer area. And when you work with, and it's important to know that when you're working with communities and when you're working with farmers and you're trying to solve problems and reach markets and do different things, it's very important to understand some of the basic, the cultural undertows that are happening at all times, because that's going to impact the success of your project. And so there's always been this tension there. And that's just the beautiful line. Because in Moldova, the Moldovans consider themselves to be Eastern Europeans, not Russian. They're
looking west, and the other part of the country is looking east.
Right, and they want very much to be a part of the EU. They've been setting themselves up. Romania's been a part of the EU. They feel part of the Romanian culture. Their language is Romanian, and one of their cultural holidays that's very important to them is August 31st, 1989. And that was the year, that was the date that they, at the end of the Soviet era, when they declared that Moldovan was the official language and that they dropped the Cyrillic alphabet as their alphabet.
Now,
and that's very important to them.
The Cyrillic alphabet is the alphabet that we associate with the old Soviet Union.
Right. The Cyrillic alphabet, yeah, we associate it, but it's basically the Slavs developed the Cyrillic alphabet. It was actually developed by, this was from an earlier project in Macedonia. It was actually written by St. Cyril and St. Methodius in Macedonia, and they traveled around all the way up to Slovakia.
And I continue to learn new things.
Yeah, and so that's who developed the alphabet. We were talking about my name pronunciation. What's always found fascinating is nobody knows, seems to be able to read my name and be able to pronounce Cadwallader. It comes out in lots of different ways, except where there's a Cyrillic alphabet, because in the Cyrillic alphabet, there's only one way to pronounce every letter. So as soon as they see my name, nail it first time every time.
Well, I'm Bohemian on my mom's side, so maybe that helped out somehow.
Yeah, there you go.
The Cyrillic alphabet is used in the Transnistria region still,
yep.
Correct?
That's correct.
And the Moldovan region uses the Roman characters,
yep,
that we use here in America.
Right.
That's got to make communication between the two regions almost impossible. They're using completely different alphabets.
Yeah, they are, but everybody was trained. I've got Facebook friends with many of these people yet, so it's fun because they'll correspond with me in English, Moldovan, and Russian. Very common for people, other than in the rural farming communities, in the urban areas in Chisinau and Balts and some of the bigger cities, very common for everybody to be able to speak and read in three different languages.
Is Moldovan as a language, is it similar to Romanian?
It is Romanian, essentially.
Okay.
And when you, it's one of the things you learn when you do a lot of international work, as I've done, is it's people get focused on when their particular country was kind of in charge of the area. So they consider Romania to be part of the old greater Moldavia. And the Romanians, of course, consider Moldova
part of Romania.
So it kind of depends on where you're
well,
from.
Well, those borders have changed quite a bit throughout
the
centuries.
Oh, yes, they've changed a lot.
Now, you mentioned that the Soviets moved a lot of Russian people into the Transnistria region of Moldova.
Right.
Why did they do that?
Well, there's lots of different reasons that these sort of movements have happened. Some of them are political, just to make sure they've distributed the population a little bit. You know, it doesn't, if you actually have, just like we're running into right now, if you have Russian communities and Russian people moving in, marrying, and starting to break down ties, that kind of helps in the politics.
Was there an economic reason? Because we understand that most of the steel production, most of the heavy industry in Moldova or in that region takes place in Transnistria.
Yep. Most of the industry was in that area. And that was a big financial investment by the Soviet Union to make those changes. So that's exactly right. I mean, some of the movements, if you go back in history, are very practical. It's droughts, it's famine, it's, you know, agriculture, they needed more workers. And the same thing happened as the economies evolved and we had factories set up. Some of it's politics, just trying to mix people up a little bit. And some of it is just favoritism. These were better paying jobs, and so they would move in. You know, so they would move in.
Send the Russians in so that instead of the Moldovans getting the good jobs.
Yeah,
I
mean,
it's, doesn't it?
Yeah, you've got to think of, these are people, they're going to make decisions for all kinds of different reasons. And you can't get too bogged down in it. You just have, especially in the work that I do, you just have to realize that it happened.
Now, Transnistria has its own currency.
Mm-hmm.
It's got its own military and its own police force.
Is
there any way at all for the Moldovan government to control what goes on there, or is it really its own country?
It's essentially its own country. It's been extremely difficult for Moldovans, and it's one of the big reasons that the EU hasn't proceeded because of this is kind of an unresolved issue.
There was actually a war, wasn't there?
There was a war in 1992. And so it was actually, so some border agreements were agreed on.
There was a ceasefire.
Yep, it was a ceasefire. I have one of my interpreters on one of my early projects picked up a job with the UNDP, United Nations Development Program. And they had the job of trying to monitor the customs stations that move through the area. Really difficult job because it's kind of a seat of, I guess, corruption in a lot of ways. Because it's kind of a no man's land in some ways, it allows all kinds of
underground economic
activity.
Stuff.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of crime and a lot of corruption.
Yeah, you can't be naive when you're working with people in this region because, you know, you can't suggest things happen. It's one of the things we talk about when we sit around the kitchen table in the evening is, okay, here's what we'd like to do, but here's what we're going to have to do because this is just the political reality on the ground. And one of those issues, and it's a big issue, is the lack of trust that goes on because of graft, corruption, little games that get played on the side. There's a lot of arms movement through the area. You know, it's kind of an area that's found favor with those who can make money off it.
Well, the UN doesn't recognize Transnistria.
No.
Moldova doesn't recognize it. Does anybody recognize it? Do the Russians recognize it?
Well, I don't know that. Do they trade with them? Yes.
Does Transnistria trade with the rest of Moldova? Is there any kind of economic?
There is some economic activity that goes across the border, but not a lot.
Are there checkpoints on the roads?
Yep, there's checkpoints along the way. And so when you actually go to the Ukraine, there's a lot of movement through the area. And another one of my interpreters, Andre, is his ex-wife and his sons live in Moscow. So he has to travel through that region to go visit Moscow. If you're going to Ukraine, if you're going to Odessa, you have to go through that. So when you're on the train, you know, traveling from Chisinau, the capital of Moldova, to Odessa.
So there are rail lines that go through.
Oh, yeah. There's rail lines, but you stop at both borders. So you're going to stop, and they're going to go through you. And so you just have to be prepared. You will be looked into at both ways. So it makes the movement of goods and services really difficult.
What is the military like in Moldova and in Transnistria? Are there military bases? Do they have any advanced weapons systems? And if so, who supplies them?
No, it's pretty basic. I was there. My last trip to Moldova was in 2011. And it was interesting. It was fun being there. I was there for their 20th anniversary of nationhood. And so there was a big military parade and, you know, with their arms and all that. And pretty basic. I mean, it's like, you know, it's pretty basic. They don't have much. If the Soviets decided they wanted to walk in there, there's not much.
All right, so the Moldovan side doesn't have much. Do they have much in the Transnistria side?
No, not a lot.
So they could have a war and not too many people would get hurt. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, they could definitely have a war against each other. But if the Soviets or anybody else got involved, it would be over very quickly.
Is there a draft? Do people have to serve in the military?
That's changed. You know, it's one of those things I talk about with there is a community service aspect and there is a draft or, you know, 1 year type deal. But it used to be very mandatory. But as time has gone on, especially with the young professionals and the educated folks, there's ways to get out of it. So they can agree to do other things and,
you're kind of like the U.S. in the 60s.
Yeah, kind of, you know, so, but there is more, you know, there is a kind of a mandate that you will have some kind of community service affiliated with helping the people or serving in the military. So everybody does have some kind of military experience.
We're talking to Tom Cadwallader. He is a retired Lincoln County UW Extension agent who spent about 10 years traveling back and forth from his home in Merrill to Moldova, a small Eastern European country nestled between Romania and Ukraine that some fear may be the next target of Vladimir Putin. We're talking about the geopolitical situation, but what we really want to talk about are the people of Moldova and their culture and the challenges that they face, which may be adding to the tensions that exist there. And Tom spent a lot of time helping farmers through the farmer-to-farmer program of the United States Agency for International Development, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. We'll be back to talk more about that and to take your phone calls at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. You're listening to a live recording of a Moldovan ensemble, the Marine Bunia Trio. You're listening to a violin, an accordion, and a bass. And if you listen to Moldovan music, a lot of it sounds like this, with old ethnic and folk music lines, kind of like the gypsy jazz of Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli on steroids, just played at an incredibly fast, frantic pace. Tom Cadwallader, what kind of music and cultural scene exists in Moldova?
Oh, that's a good question. It's, you know, one of the things that you pick up on when you travel through Eastern Europe, there is a strong, I don't know, just a strong sense of nation or community around music. If you, in the United States today, in the era that I've grown up in, people come away, you know, some people are into country music, some people are into rock and roll. I'm from Detroit, so I'm a rock and roller. Sorry. My kids are all country folks. You know, and there's, other than a few songs that we might share from the Beatles or something like that, if, you know, people are so fragmented in our music interest. There is some of that in Eastern Europe and in Moldova. But when these songs come up, when these Everybody knows them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the whole room will all of a sudden, we'll be at dinner or on a luncheon or something like that, and if one of these songs come up, everybody stops what they're doing and they all join in. If young, old, it's just a part of their identity. It's a part of their culture. And they identify so strongly with those roots. And it's something that we lose track of in the U.S., and it's hard to kind of imagine. There may have been a time that it happened, but we're such a mix of heritages there. There's just, you can just sense it.
Well, radio and the mass media have really splintered the culture in America within my lifetime.
Oh, absolutely.
It used to be that we heard all the same songs on top 40 radio, and now, if you're into country, you listen to a country station. If you like rock, you listen to a rock station, and it's like, there isn't a lot of cross-pollination.
No. There is some cross. I mean, some of the musical themes that we've come up with are really a blend of so many different things. But it's a part of their culture. These themes, these rhythms are just there.
Is dance an important part of that too?
Traditional
costumes.
Yeah, traditional costume and dance. And most homes that you go into are very, you see the same themes in terms of decorations and all. It's just, very common. Throughout the Soviet era, even though religion was put on the back burner, a lot of the cathedrals and the churches that are spread around, very few of them were destroyed somewhere. They might have been, moved to a different purpose. They might have been a stable or something like that. But that's one of the first things that happened at the breakup of the Soviet Union is all of these churches came back to life. And so you'll see many of the themes around it. Even though these aren't deeply religious people, they all have the affiliation. It's a part of their ethnic background.
Are the churches the same in Greater Moldova as opposed to this breakaway Russian province, Transnistria?
Yeah. There's the Eastern Orthodox or Russian Orthodox Church kind of cuts across. Area.
Well, there's one thing that's unifying them.
Yeah, that's right. It's in one way that is a unifying force. So this is really difficult for the people who live there because they have such, over the years they've evolved. And that's, one of the, we were talking about the movement of people. The Russians and the czars before them, understood that if you want to get people to get along with each other, you kind of got to forcefully move them around. Mm-hmm. And then if things are stable enough, people intermarry and all that kind of stuff. So it's just kind of a stabilizing force within the, but on the other hand, people have a tendency to maintain their national ethnic identity, what they feel part of.
So you mentioned,
it never totally goes away.
You mentioned that Transnistria still has a statue of Lenin.
Yep.
In the square. Communism was an atheist philosophy. Is there still an atheist train of thought running through the Transnistria region or maybe through Moldova? Or have people pretty much chucked that and gone back to the old religion?
No, there's not a strong movement back to the religion, but there is, it was something that was buried away. When the churches opened up, all of the seniors, and they still do, attend church every Sunday. I mean, there's that, and so that does impact the younger generation. So, we had some really interesting discussions about that.
Tell me about the discussions.
Well, in order to be successful in these types of projects, I've been to so many different countries, I wouldn't even know what language to learn if I was going to learn a new language. You become very, very close to your interpreters. And most of these folks are young people, I'm always working with people that are in their early 20s, mid-20s or something like that. So it's really fun and to get to know them because for me to be successful, I have to depend on them to interpret between the culture that I'm mm-hmm. working with and my knowledge. And so I first of all have to teach them. We have to be on the same page because they have to find the right words to interpret the idea. And so because of that, we talk about all kinds of stuff. So you talk about family, you talk about history, you talk about religion. And the young people have a sense that religion they understand the need for it. They're glad that they have that freedom now. And if they go through rough times, if religion has become a more important part of their lives.
Do they have the same cultural attachment to it that the old people have?
No. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you don't sense that there's some desire to have it. One of the first things you find out is that when you travel in these areas, the Mennonite church is there big time. There's a lot of American Mennonites that will travel there.
Is it predominantly Christian, or are there Muslims there too?
It's predominantly Christian, but there are some Muslim communities. But in Moldova, it's primarily Eastern
Orthodox.
Is there
tension with the Muslim minority, like there apparently is in
not
Crimea?
Not really. Not really. It kind of depends on the area you go into. I did some work in Azerbaijan and near Georgia, and so it's a little bit different down there. You do have some, you know, as you probably are aware of, Ossetia and some of those regions, which are very similar to Transnistria. I mean,
how did a guy from Merrill, Tom Cadwallader, a UW Extension agent used to working with farmers in north central Wisconsin, how did you end up going to this former part of the Soviet Union?
Oh, well, that was actually thanks to a fellow who used to work at NTC many years ago, 20-some years ago. My first project was in 1993 in Macedonia and Slovakia, who Ted Gashler, and Ted had, you know, he was with the farm training program at NTC, and he just loved international stuff, and so he took on a project as a country director for one of the first farmer-to-farmer programs in Macedonia. And so Ted had me, and we were good friends, and he had me. I was the first volunteer to go into Macedonia in 1993, the first farmer-to-farmer. I was their last one in 2002 after 10 years.
Now farmer-to-farmer is part of the U.S. Agency for International Development?
Yeah, actually, it's funded through the Farm Bill.
And that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Yes. And it's actually extremely popular.
And all of that was started by President Kennedy back in the early 60s, the agency anyway, the Agency for International Development.
Yeah, right. That was a lot of things were all started at that time, of course, AID and the Peace Corps and all that came out through the early 60s.
There must be other folks like you in Wisconsin who are doing the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. No, there's lots of folks probably could be listening right now who have done farmer-to-farmer programs. And as an extensionist, it fits exactly what we do.
What kinds of things were you telling the farmers? I mean, here they're used to an old Soviet-style, top-down, you know, state-controlled economy, and they've got to adjust to a market economy. What sorts of things were you trying to teach them?
Well, most of it is teaching. It's working on decision-making. And, you know, one of the projects that I had in Moldova was with an old collective farm that was getting up and running and transitioning over, and the woman I was working with, it was a swine project, and so what we were talking about is a decision making structure. She was actually a team leader on that collective farm, you know, back in the Soviet era, and you know, I asked her once. I said, "How long? You know, how far in advance did you plan your activities? I mean, you were a team mm-hmm. leader, had some management responsibilities." She was a week. That was it.
That's not much.
Not much. The actual workers didn't know what they were going to do till they got to work that day.
No 5-year plan? No 10-year plan?
No. They had 5-year plans. That I learned in my first trip to Slovakia. I was working with, that's a whole other story, working with a former actor. Their version of Clint Eastwood. Yeah, he was. It was a famous actor. It was really a trip traveling through the the mountains with as everywhere we went, everybody knew the guy and wanted to give him a shot of vodka. And so anyways, I was there to help him develop a business plan. Yeah, we went into the local official. And he heard about our plan, and of course he was one of the old Soviet guys, and he just looked at me and just shook his head. He said, "Plans? I've seen plans." He opened up this wall, and there was his 5-year plans all the way through the 20s, 30s, 40s. Basically, that was demanded that you will all have a 5-year plan. So they were used to doing planning.
But they didn't like it very much.
Yeah, they didn't like it. And the thing is, they didn't pay any attention to it. And they basically, they went through the planning process. Well, that was helpful for me. It was kind of an eye-opener because we have to temper. So it was basically what helping them do strategic planning from their own standpoint so that it was meaningful, so that it was their plan and how to use that. That's what we're really good at in the United States here. Because, and we have companies, and I've seen land use plans and all that stuff. It just collects dust on the wall.
Right.
But for companies and for communities that really are thriving, they generally have always got a plan kind of in motion. They look out into the future, but they're always adjusting and trying to, you know, capture reality as it evolves. So a plan has to be a living document.
But a lot of those plans aren't just top down, they're bottom up as well. You get feedback from the people.
Absolutely. And that's what you find out. And so what I would work with many times, that's why it's very important for me to understand the culture. And land tenure is extremely important to know, especially when it comes to agricultural production. You have to know who owns the land and how, what's their attachment to the land, because that's going to have a big impact on whether you can do things or can't do things. And I'm not making any statement about whether it's better to, you know, have the land held in a community's basis or private individuals. Of course, I would rather see private individuals.
What's it like in Moldova right now? Do private individuals own the land?
Yes. But that becomes a problem because they turned over collective farms, went back into private hands. I had to learn lots about their laws. They tried a few things in the beginning, didn't work out. Moldova has been a part of the Soviet realm since well before World War II. And because of that, many people that held title for whatever reason lost it early on and have long gone. So when they tried to give the land back to the people who originally owned it, there was nobody around. They either went to Europe, they went to the United States.
How did they divide it?
Well, then it got to the point they created a new program, which basically just gave just about everybody who belonged to the community that worked at the collective fire 5 hectares. Well,
you can't grow a lot.
You can't grow a lot on 5 hectares. And so you'll see this patchwork of farms that are really poorly managed, and so people will try to lease them out, and so it's kind of cobbled up. So some of those more successful things that I helped groups with in the beginning was to set up cooperatives based on equipment sharing. Well, that actually was some of the more successful cooperatives because they would help these little landowners with, you know, rent out equipment and then help them market their products and all that kind of stuff.
Where did they get the equipment from? Do they manufacture it in Moldova? Do they have to import it from other European countries?
Yeah, other European countries and former Soviet countries. It's really fun going to their agricultural fairs because I get to see equipment that is just really crazy, but works beautiful. So,
do people own cars there?
Yeah, people own cars. It's
how big is the middle class?
Well, I would have to say that most of the people are middle class. It's one of the first things that I've noticed and became obvious to me is I grew up in the Detroit area in the 50s and 60s when there was huge middle class. And as time has gone on, our society has begun to fragment and divide itself out. And we've kind of, we've talked about it. We're hollowing out the middle and making it very difficult as people gravitate and we're able to move to communities that we want to live in and people gravitate around. But we really, our economy was based on a well-distributed economy. So the people were sharing in that. One of the things you notice when you go into these countries is there's a huge middle class. There's the people who are on the upper scale in terms of politics are really folksy. I mean, they're right at home on the farms. They're very much a part of the rural community, and people all kind of feel like they're in the same boat.
We have heard that in Russia, which used to be communist, where the ideal was everybody has basically the same amount. And now you've got a few billionaires, a few oligarchs who own everything.
Absolutely.
And everyone else is in poverty. And you're telling me the same thing didn't happen to Moldova.
No, it's kind of the same thing. You do have what you call the oligarchs. But what you'll find, though, is you'll find a huge middle class of people that are well-educated with very little opportunity for advancement, so that are all kind of competing. And, you know, lots of folks, the ones that can are moving to Europe and working in jobs and sending the money back to Moldova with the idea that someday they'd love to move back to Moldova and buy a farm. And so you'll see all kinds of different business arrangements that are going on. Now, there is just a different community feel to it than you sense around here.
Former UW Lincoln County Extension agent Tom Cadwallader, who has spent many years in Moldova, a small Eastern European country nestled between Ukraine and Romania that some fear may be the next target of Vladimir Putin's troops. We're talking about the Transnistria region, which is heavily Russian, which wants to break away from Moldova and become part of Russia. And we're talking about the people and the culture of Greater Moldova. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got about 10 minutes left. 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can leave a message on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We are talking to Tom Cadwallader, a former UW Extension agent who has spent a lot of time in Moldova, a tiny European country that may be the next target of Vladimir Putin's troops. At least some of the top commanders in NATO fear that. We're talking about the ethnic Moldovan population and one part of the country which is heavily Russian. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let's go to Jim, who's calling us from west of Wausau. Jim, you're on Route 51 with Tom Cadwallader.
Hi, Glenn. Hi, Tom. I'm Jim Schneider. I worked at MTC in the farm training program, and I've had some very similar experiences in Ukraine. In fact, on one of the trips working with university professors there, we did sneak across the border into Moldova from Odessa and visited a large collective farm there.
Tom, you know the area better than I do. You got a question for Jim or?
It's good to hear you, Jim.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah, I know the area too. And of course, those were back in the early 90s, I think, Jim, when you were there and some of that work was going on and the Moldovans that I know, when I told them I was in Odessa and traveled through that part of the country, they were worried. They go, wow, you were willing to do that because it was a pretty crazy time back in those days, because it was not easy to travel and it was fairly dangerous.
Yes. I mean, we would go out, with our sponsors and, sometimes my wife was with me too. Both times we were over there and, you know, you could disappear off the face of the earth and nobody know where you were.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Well, Jim Schneider, what do you think the future of this region is going to be? Do you think Ukraine will be able to look further toward the West and toward Europe and become a European-style democracy? What do you think the future holds for Moldova, or don't you know?
I would say it's kind of a toss-up at this point. You know, it depends an awful lot on what President Putin decides he wants to do. He might pull the same thing he did in Crimea. And when we were there in 94, we were in Crimea working with people in Simferopol, and they were terrified that they were going to be attacked by the Russians back then. So I don't know. It's really tough. I hope that Ukraine gets to go with Europe. Or with both Russia and Europe would be even better.
Jim, thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate you calling in and sharing some of your experiences.
Well, I think Jim brings up a good point, and that's why it's a very difficult one, because the Moldovans don't want to be Europeans. They want to be Moldovans, but they want the freedoms that they see the West has had. They're on Facebook. They see what's going on.
So they have internet connections in Moldova.
Oh, they have excellent internet connections.
How about the Transnistria region?
They've got internet connections, but it's so the people are tossed. I mean, they don't want to be, they don't have the desire to be Americans. They don't want to be Germans, but they want the good things that we have, and they want to blend them in with their culture and what they feel is important. And I was there in 2009 when the president Voronin was reelected, and right after the elections, there was a huge uprising. They were burning. There was riots in the streets. I went to bed at night listening to tear gas guns going off. And it was just amazing to talk with, because this was, you know, we've heard about the Arab Spring uprisings and basically this was one of the predecessors of that. That's essentially what it was. It was the young people who wanted opportunity. They want to be a part of the EU. They want to see what progress is, but they still want to be Moldovans. They don't want to move. They want to be able to develop and to use their skills and tap into some opportunities.
Should we be teaching our kids in America more about the geopolitical landscape of Eastern Europe, the former Soviet republics, about the people, their languages, their culture, their economy, and their politics?
Oh, absolutely. Well, wherever you can. And the thing is, because people move around so much, I was always kind of frustrated. This goes back to, my children growing up, they were exposed to, because I also hosted groups here in the United States, especially from Macedonia. And those had a big impact on my children because to have them go to the children's schools to learn about these areas and answer their questions. And that's extremely important. And to be able to do that, it's sad that we don't have more of that activity to introduce people and actually meet each other one-on-one.
What are your hopes for the future of Moldova? If things would work out the way Tom Cadwallader wants them to work out in the years ahead, what will happen there?
Well, I think it's just what I had mentioned before, and that is I hope that, the people, they want to make progress. They got rid of what they thought was a corrupt president and President Voronin, who was very much tied to he was in the Communist Party. And they didn't like the way the election came out, and so they had to create a new government. The only thing I would ever hope, it's like what I do with any group that I work with, that they're able to guide their own future, wherever that may lead, and not have it imposed on them by us, by Russia. And you said it earlier, the ideal situation is that they're able to gather and use the best of both of the worlds, that they're in between, and not to have to be forced into going one direction or the other.
Tom, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We want to thank today's guest, former Lincoln County UW Extension agent Tom Cadwallader. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger, and a special thanks to Vicki Richmond Hawkins of UW Extension for her assistance on this program. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from the 2006 CD, Moldovan Folk Music, also the Marin Bunea Trio, and the Beatles. Remember to follow us on Facebook if you missed some of this broadcast. Route 51 is repeated in its entirety every Friday evening at 7 on 90.9 FM Wausau and can be downloaded at wpr.org, Route 51. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.
In the the U.S.